and I essentially began investigating the process by which this deposed caliph launched a scheme or a plot or a conspiracy to revive the Ottoman Caliphate in India.
It was something I never heard about. And I was like, what are you on about?
I think you're well regarded in terms of history as well. He was exiled. The Turkish Republic decided that, you know, this isn't going to work having a caliph in Istanbul. So they bundled him and his family onto the Orient Express and sent him off to Switzerland.
How was that state in India functioning? Like, how did they have so much wealth and still be under British colonialism?
It wasn't a plot to take over India and to have the caliph rule over India. The Nizam of Hyderabad was a incredible man who was so wealthy, the richest man in the world, and yet he was famously austere.
It's unbelievable almost how much colonialism has impacted Muslim psyche.
It was part of British imperial ideology to say that Britain was the greatest Muslim power in the world. British imperial thinkers came up with this idea. It was then repeated by British prime ministers, including Winston Churchill. Now, why would there be an Ottoman tomb, an Ottoman mausoleum, in the middle of Western India, in the middle, apparently, of nowhere? It's completely insane.
As you can see, I have zero papers.
Yeah, that's fine. It's probably better.
Good. I don't think I've arrived with zero papers. I've always, even if there's nothing written on the paper, I have a paper and a pen. Because it's like, I need to be like, oh, he says something and I make it, I write one
so
word.
So this is the first time you've ever done it with zero paper?
Yeah, but also it's the printer not working. And so what's the point? Hi, good day. Welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. I'm your host, Ishfaq Karim. And today, I'm very happy to be joined by my own colleague, one of Middle East Eye's youngest and brightest reporters, Imran Mullah.
Very happy to be here, Ishfaq. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you, Imran. So Imran's speaking to me because, I mean, he is a very good reporter, but we're not speaking about his reporting. He's just authored a book. Imran, tell us about the book.
Well, it's called The Indian Caliphate, Exiled Ottomans and the Billionaire Prince. It's out very soon here in the UK. It'll be out soon in other countries. In India, it's out in January. This book is a narrative history and... Well, let's put it like this. About a year and a half ago, I randomly found myself in the wilderness in Maharashtra, which is a western state in India. And I was trekking through, there was sort of jungle nearby. There were potential for deadly animals, but I sort of didn't know about them, thankfully. And I was looking for a monument which no one in the region really knew what it was. But I knew I had to find it. It was a friend, me and a friend. So it was about 40 degrees Celsius. We were sort of we were walking through, and then we saw it on the horizon, this magnificent Ottoman mausoleum. So about, you know, 20 meters tall. It's huge. Now, why would there be an Ottoman tomb, an Ottoman mausoleum, in the middle of Western India, in the middle, apparently, of nowhere? It's completely insane. So we got up to it, and it's slightly crumbling. It's completely empty. There's no body in there. So whoever was supposed to be buried in there wasn't actually buried there. There's graffiti on the walls. You know, this is the sort of place people, you know, young lovers would sort of come and visit, but they had no idea what it was, essentially. And it's Turkish in style. So the book is really an attempt to answer the question of why on earth there's an Ottoman tomb in the middle of remote India. And the person I discovered who planned to be buried in that tomb, but who ultimately wasn't, was none other than the last Ottoman caliph. So the last nominal leader of the Sunni Islamic world, Abdulmajid II, who was exiled from Istanbul in 1924 after the Ottoman Empire fell and after the caliphate was abolished. I first sort of came across this because I was very interested in Abdulmajid's artwork. So he was a painter. He painted sort of orientalist style European painting. He did Islamic calligraphy. He loved European classical music and Ottoman classical music. So he's a talented cellist, a harpsichordist, a pianist. Fascinating kind of quintessential, cultivated, educated, liberal, tolerant, pluralistic, modernist prince. But this is a guy who's going to become the last caliph of the Islamic world. And when he eventually ascended to that title, it was 1922. The Ottoman Empire had completely crumbled. The Sultanate was abolished. And Abdul-Majid was appointed caliph by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and elected into the role by the new Grand National Assembly of the modern state of Turkey, which had just been created. So he was the first and the only caliph of modern Turkey. And this was absolutely unprecedented. You had a sort of an elected caliph, although obviously he was an Ottoman prince and he had been the Ottoman crown prince, so he was sort of considered to be suitable for the role. But very soon afterwards, in 1924, in March, he was exiled. The Turkish Republic decided that, you know, this isn't going to work, having a caliph in Istanbul who's sort of doing these grand processions and not shutting up. So they bundled him and his family onto the Orient Express and sent him off to Switzerland. And eventually he ended up in France in a nice seafront villa on the French Riviera. So I was fascinated by what exactly he did in exile, because most generally historians have dismissed or ignored what happened to this guy. Everyone's focused on the fact that this was monumental for the Islamic world because now there's no caliphate. It's obviously monumental for Turkey because it's the birth of the new nation. But what on earth happened to this kind of this painter, musician, caliph? He didn't accept the abolition of the caliphate, unsurprisingly. This is what I quite quickly learn. And I essentially began investigating the process by which this deposed caliph launched a scheme or a plot or a conspiracy to revive the Ottoman caliphate in India, in the princely state of Hyderabad, which was a state the size of Italy. It was a very wealthy, modernizing state ruled by the Nizam of Hyderabad, who was a billionaire prince, the richest Muslim in the world, but also at one point the richest man in the world. And this was the Yusuf Jahi dynasty, the wealthiest Muslim dynasty in the world. And with the help of the Nizam, this plot was launched essentially to find a new future for the Ottoman line and also for the Islamic world. And this was a plot which eventually failed because of the Indian partition in 1947, and in 1948, the new Indian government launched an invasion of Hyderabad, and so it came to nothing. And after that, the scheme was consigned to the sort of dustbin of history. But more than that, it was covered up and it was kept secret. So this book is an attempt to excavate and uncover this forgotten history.
Okay. Sounds fascinating, right? And I mean, you told me about this book, I think, about 8 months ago. You were already kind of writing it, maybe a bit longer. I know Imran, by the way, since I've been here, which is about 19 months ago. And initially, I do think that I'm quite well regarded in terms of history, but this was something I never heard about. And I was like, what are you on about?
I think you're well regarded in terms of history as well.
Right. So this is quite interesting. But what, I mean, I want to ask you what drew you to the book. But before you answer, I want two answers, right? So the one is there's an intellectual aspect, right? There's the aspect of India under partition, under colonialism, and then having to do with partition and it becoming a very different state to what it was 100 years ago. And there's all that massive discussion which really precedes the crumbling of the Ottoman Empire almost by 100 years, which is what happens to the Khalifate, right? There's already in Turkey in the 1800s a movement to kind of have some sort of constitutional monarchy or a democracy or a parliament. As you said, the Abdul-Majid, not Abdul-Hamid, his predecessor, was quite modern, was quite thinking about these things anyway. So there's an interesting point in history, right? So from that intellectual aspect, because I'm going to stop speaking now, you tell me what drove you towards that. But then also personally, like, where were you in your life? How did you come across the story? And you were like, I'm gonna go and try to find this mausoleum. Like what were both those journeys like?
Well, maybe to start with the personal one, I came across this while I was studying history at Cambridge, and I was studying, conveniently, both Ottoman history and modern South Asian history at exactly the same time. And so it was a sort of perfect... That was the time when I came across Caliph Abdul-Majid and his work. And I also was reading a lot about these Muslim thinkers and politicians in early 20th century India. So when I say India in this period, it's the subcontinent, not the modern nation state of India. So it encompasses what is now Pakistan and Bangladesh.
It's under British rule.
It's under British rule, yes.
Right.
So that was the time when I started to piece this story together. Although I did this ultimately not while studying history, but afterwards, when I was working at Middle East Eye. I just kept researching this, and it was more and more fascinating. And the reason it was initially fascinating to me was that the characters involved, the main figures, are so colourful and so extraordinary. And to be fair, you know, lots of people have written about these figures. Like the Nizam of Hyderabad was this incredible man who was so wealthy, the richest man in the world, and yet he was famously austere. You know, he once stormed away from an ice cream store after the price was too high, and he would sort of write things on old scraps of paper, and he frowned upon people taking, you know, too much food at dinners. And this very austere man, a very shrewd, intelligent ruler, a modernist, very pluralistic. So he was a Muslim ruler over a state that had a Hindu majority, but he declared Hindus and Muslims are my two eyes, and he patronized Hindu temples and gurdwaras and churches as well as mosques. So an altogether fascinating ruler. You had Caliph Abdul Majid, who had cultivated himself as the democrat prince and who had called for a constitutional monarchy within the Ottoman Empire. And then you also had all these modernist Muslim intellectuals and politicians who actually came up with this plan to create an Indian caliphate, which is to say a caliphate that would be centered in India. So it wasn't a plot to take over India and to have the caliph rule over India, it's important to say. It was essentially a plan whereby the Nizam of Hyderabad, the ruler of this huge princely state, would also be the caliph of Islam. And the idea was that he would gain recognition from Muslims across the world. And this would be great for the subcontinent standing in the Islamic world and India's sort of soft power with the Middle East. So that was how I came to the stories, through these incredible people. One of them, Marmaduke Pickthall, a British Muslim intellectual convert, whose translation of the Quran is still read widely today. And Pickthall was actually patronized and commissioned to write that Quran by the Nizam of Hyderabad. And he was a modernist. He had a lot of dealings with the Ottomans. And he, together with an Indian Muslim politician, Maulana Shaukat Ali, who was very significant, one of the leaders of the famous Khilafat movement in the final days of the Ottoman Empire, which was an Indian movement, a mass mobilization of Hindus and Muslims in support of the Ottomans and against the European occupation of Anatolia, essentially. So Maulana Shaukat Ali, a veteran of this movement, a former close ally and friend of Gandhi, and a very significant Indian politician who knew all the big figures and indeed was sort of their mentor. He was like a mentor to Jawaharlal Nehru, for example. He was a close friend of Muhammad Ali Jinnah. He and Pickthall together came up with this plan that what we're going to do is we're going to broker a marriage between the deposed caliph's daughter, Princess Durrashivar, an Ottoman princess, and the Nizam's eldest son, Prince Azam Jah. And this union will be the union, you know, it'll be a marriage, but it'll also be the union of two of Islam's greatest houses, the House of Usman, the Ottoman dynasty.
Like the Game of Thrones.
Exactly. And the Asafjahi dynasty, the wealthiest Muslim dynasty in the world. And this will bring together the Ottoman legacy and the legacy of the Mughal Empire, because Hyderabad claimed itself as the last flowering of Indo-Islamic civilization and an inheritor of the cultural legacy of the Mughals. So it would bring these two together. It would be a coming together of the Islamic West and the Islamic East. And that is what happened. This marriage took place in 1931. And the firstborn son of that marriage, Prince Mukarram Jah, was actually designated secretly to be the next Nizam of Hyderabad, so passing over his father. While he was a baby, it was secretly decided he's going to be the next ruler. And there's considerable evidence which I've gathered that the last Ottoman caliph wanted him to become the next caliph, essentially. This was his grandson, and he was the Nizam's grandson as well. So you have this extraordinary, very colourful tale, you know, from the French Riviera with all its sort of glamour and excitement to Istanbul, you know, the last days of Ottoman Istanbul, to Bombay and Hyderabad. Hyderabad, this incredible princely state whose palaces were drenched with opulence, and, you know, the extravagance of its courtly life was often compared to the Arabian Nights, but it was also a very important modernizing princely state. So a very colorful story. But why is it important? You might say, well, the plan failed and it came to nothing, and who cares? I think it's important because it's a story of global connections, of these sort of extraordinary transnational alliances that cut across national borders, that cut across imperial borders. It's a forgotten slice of global history, which reveals just how interconnected the world really was, and also reveals India's incredibly important ties with the Middle East, and also its central role in the global Islamic world in the early 20th century, which is something that I think has been forgotten. So that, to me, is a great intellectual significance of the story. Now, I can talk more as well about the caliphate and the Ottoman caliphate, which is another very important political dimension. The Ottoman caliphate, as people know, sort of began in the 16th century. The Ottomans governed the three holy cities of Islam, so it's very easy for them to claim to be the caliphs. But what I was really interested in was how the caliphate, which traditionally connotes succession to the Prophet of Islam, how it underwent significant transformations, and it was sort of repeatedly reconstituted. So in the medieval period, you had the Abbasid Caliphate, and that was defined by jurists, by the ulama, as being literally succession to the Prophet. But jurists generally believed that the Caliph had to be from the Prophet's tribe. Now, the Ottomans were not Arab, so this posed quite a problem for them. So the Ottomans, they used a different form of a different set of ideas to justify their caliphate. And the ulama basically took a step back, and the Ottomans elevated these philosophers and Sufis who came up with a mystical definition of the caliphate. And the caliph was now seen as God's shadow on earth, as a sort of a mystical figure endowed with, you know, all these special attributes, and the Ottoman caliphate was destined to be, you know, the seal of the caliphate, and it was supposed to go on until the end of time. And this was an entirely new vision of the caliphate. And there's often this myth, actually, that the caliphate wasn't important to the Ottomans until the 19th century. But actually, it really was. It was sort of the linchpin of imperial ideology. But then in the 19th century, you get a new sort of discourse about the caliphate, which comes from the loss of Ottoman power. So Sultan Abdul Hamid, who you mentioned, was this modern autocratic sultan who was very successful in many ways. And the empire by now had lost a lot of its European possessions, so it had way fewer Christians in the empire. It was more of a Muslim empire in terms of demographics than it had ever been. But also Muslims across the world were now under European colonial rule. So Abdul Hamid came up with this idea of the caliphate as being representative of Muslims across the world, not just Muslims within his empire. And at this time, because Muslims in India, who hadn't cared about the Ottoman caliphate at all, now had to contend with being under British rule, they were suddenly interested in the Ottoman caliphate. So this was a new form of the caliphate, obviously with crucial elements in common to past caliphates. And it was also absolutist. So Abdul Hamid was... he started off as a constitutional sultan. He was brought to power after a coup by the young Ottomans, and they established a constitution, a parliament. He was the sultan. And then suddenly he changed his mind and dissolved parliament, and then governed as an absolutist authoritarian ruler for decades. And then you had the 1908 Young Turk Revolution. Now, it's often assumed, often by Muslims, that this was entirely a sort of westernizing kind of phenomenon, and they were on the side of the West and anti-Islam, and Abdul Hamid was the Islamic Sultan. But actually, some very good recent research, including by the British historian Yaqub Ahmed, has shown that the ulama were heavily involved in this revolution in 1908, which instituted a constitutional caliphate. So now Abdul Hamid, he was eventually deposed in 1909. But now the Sultan, who was the caliph, was essentially derived his legitimacy from the constitution and from parliament. So he couldn't get rid of the constitution. So it was a very modern, very democratic idea, but which used reasoning that was also very Islamic. So it was a modern Islamic semi-quasi-democratic vision of the caliphate. And then the Young Turks became more and more authoritarian as time went on. And that brings us to our guy, Caliph Abdul Majid II. When he comes in, he had been a big supporter of constitutionalism, but now there's no empire, there's no sultanate, so he doesn't actually hold power, and his legitimacy officially comes from the Grand National Assembly of Turkey. So think about Britain today. You know, you have King Charles, who doesn't actually really hold power. He's sort of a figurehead of the nation. This was Caliph Abdul Majid, except he didn't think about it in those terms. He saw his legitimacy as being derived from the recognition of the world's Muslims. And in this situation, it was the Indian Muslims which mattered the most, because they had been clamoring most loudly for the caliphate. And they really were the reason why Ataturk didn't abolish the caliphate initially, along with the sultanate. He said, we have to keep the caliphate. So when the caliphate was abolished, Abdul Majid argued that this is completely illegitimate. No, my authority doesn't come from the Grand National Assembly. It comes from the recognition of the world's Muslims. And he made this grand proclamation from his hotel in Switzerland, where he was exiled, saying that it is now for the Muslim world alone to decide in complete liberty and with full authority on this question of the caliphate. So this was a vision for a radically reconstituted, modern, post-imperial caliphate, which derived its legitimacy not from an empire, but from recognition of the world's Muslims. So a very, very modern idea.
Okay. So as you're speaking, and thanks, it's a great story, right? As you're speaking, there was all sorts of light bulbs going on in my head, and there's a few. So I'll just address some, so that we can, you know, I mean, but I'll ask a few questions and then just go, because I think this is great, the fact that you're just speaking this long. So the first is, it's unbelievable almost how much colonialism has impacted Muslim psyche, right? I think in the 1800s, in both spaces, in Hyderabad, I mean, it's a bit different there because the Brits are already there and there's these princely states. So answer a bunch of questions there. Why is there so much wealth when, the British are, for all intents and purposes, have occupied and colonized India? But also, both states seem to be very modern. They both seem to be very pluralistic, responding to the big debates of our age. Both obviously have a sense that they will not be non-existent in about 100 or 120 years, right? They both probably think we're going to exist for a while. We need to modernize so we can keep that there. And when people, and then they eventually become vanquished, and to a large extent, what they spiritually represent, the caliphate for, you know, Muslims around the world, also they lose this caliphate, but they also, to some extent, while they gain some autonomy, a lot of them go deeper into colonization before freedom. And now now when people think of Islamic movements, or people think of, they see it in opposition to imperialism, they see it as less pluralistic. How did that being lost impact that? But also just like how was that state in India functioning? Like how did they have so much wealth and still be under British colonialism?
Well, it's a very good question. So Hyderabad under the Asif Jahi dynasty began before British rule. It was essentially a part of the Mughal Empire, and then it broke away when the Mughal Empire was splintering. And then in the 19th century, it came under British rule. So the princely states were interesting because we often think of the British ruling over India, but about a third of India's landmass was not under direct British rule. It was under the princely states, so who were technically subordinate to the British, and there would be a British political resident, you know, at the court. But they generally had autonomy in their internal affairs. And so you'd have sort of a lot of variety between what went on in different princely states and a lot of difference between the princely states and colonial rule. So there are a lot of debates about the nature of British colonialism in India. And one interesting way of actually measuring this is comparing British India to what life was like under the princely states. You'd find that millions of people commonly died in famine under British rule as a result, essentially, of colonial policy. But in the princely states, you didn't have these famines. So in Hyderabad, there was this phenomenon of, tens of thousands of refugees always streaming into the state because there was no famine relief in British India, but there was famine relief in Hyderabad. So the Nizam sort of governed as he wanted. And in a way, it was very old-fashioned. It was becoming extremely old-fashioned because the British India democratized to an extent. So you had the growth of political parties. There were, limited elections. In Hyderabad, there wasn't any of this. The Nizam wanted to keep his power. There was a lot of political reform and there was sort of very limited kind of democracy, but it was sort of doing its own thing. So in a way, it was quite anachronistic, even though it was modernizing. But the Nizam really was seen as a ruler in his own right. It wasn't just that, he's a puppet of the British. No, he saw himself as one of his titles was the faithful ally of the British, and he saw himself as an equal of the British, and he's very important. He rules this huge state, and he had a credible claim to being the premier Muslim ruler in the world. Partially because of his vast wealth, but also because Hyderabad was this incredible hub for Muslims across the world. So you had a lot of Muslims from the Arab world and from East Africa in Hyderabad at the time, often working as administrators or as soldiers. There were a lot of Arab and East African soldiers in Hyderabad. But also there was a state in southern Yemen called the Gayati Sultanate, which was essentially founded with funds from Hyderabad. So for this book, I actually interviewed the dispossessed last sultan of the Gayati Sultanate, Sultan Ghalib al-Gayati, who is actually related to the Nizam. The Nizam, I believe, was his great uncle because there was a marital alliance between the two dynasties. This is a sultan who's an Arab sultan of this southern part of Yemen, and speaks perfect Urdu, and he had all these recollections of the Nizam, and he was telling me all about this, and they would wear sherwanis often in the old days, and a lot of rulers in that part of the Gulf did. The Sultan of Oman, I should add, actually still sometimes wears sherwanis to this day, and that's because these states were effectively governed like Indian princely states under Britain's Indian Empire. So it's very easy to dismiss this as, they're just these random princes messing around under British rule. But actually, no, they were very important, and they were considered to be important, and they were considered to be powerful. And another thing I'll say is that in this period, largely because of the British Empire, India took on this role of being the epicenter of the Islamic world. So it was part of British imperial ideology to say that Britain was the greatest Muslim power in the world. British imperial thinkers came up with this idea. It was then repeated by British prime ministers, including Winston Churchill. And this was on the grounds that Britain, the British Empire, had more Muslims within it than any other empire, including the Ottoman Empire. And what's even more interesting is that Indian Muslim thinkers themselves in the late 19th and early 20th centuries adopted this idea of Britain being the greatest Muslim power in the world. And they used that when they were protesting and bargaining with the British authorities that, you know, Britain is as much a Mohammedan power as it is a Christian power. And so you have to fulfill your obligations to us. And India defined Britain's policy towards the Middle East. Middle East was between India and Britain in many ways. And it defined British policy towards Islam as well. So even during World War One, British policy was to some extent restrained because they were so terrified of discontent from India, which was very real. And then, as we know, the fact that the caliph remained after the sultanate was abolished by Turkey was in no small part because of Indian interest in this as well. And that was also why Ataturk eventually decided we've got to get rid of the caliphate because I'm getting way too much interest from other parts of the Islamic world. And so Turkish nationalism clashed with this kind of pan-Islamic idea. So that's India's place within the Islamic world.
Okay. I mean, I think just looking, identifying the patterns, right? So the Ottomans had this way of sort of dealing with their bureaucracy by empowering locals, local kings, nobles, and this is how they managed. And it seems like this is exactly how the British did it. And they did it the same, I mean, to a much lesser extent, but it was also, they did the same thing in Africa, in South Africa, because they empowered local kings who, in South Africa, it's a bit different because these are kings that didn't have as much wealth and as much connections. And but they empower them. And so I can see how there were these little states and British colonialism needed to empower.
Some of them not so little, by the way. Like
absolutely.
It's the size of Italy.
No, but I mean, it's exactly what happens after World War One, because in Sykes-Picot, and we always, and this is interesting because we always see this, the Sykes-Picot thing as a Middle Eastern thing, right? And we need these little kingdoms. And it's interesting because they empower kings. It's the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. It's the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They create these little Sykes-Picot kingdoms. Even in Egypt at the time, there's a king there, and you can see how this model was, because they weren't kings initially. This was all part of the Ottoman Empire, and yes, Egypt was kind of semi-autonomous, but this was almost like a governance structure that will empower local kings. Obviously, critics of this will rightfully say that this was a British strategy. They'd empower noble people, elites, to kind of keep people subordinate. Bear in mind, this is how the world is functioning at the time, right? That there are kings, there aren't democratic states all over the place. But that's just very, very interesting. You can comment on that because, I mean, why not? You probably have a lot more to say on it. But just, I want to kind of understand, because you mentioned you spoke to the king of the Haiti
Sultan.
Haiti Sultan, right? What was the process in terms of you saying, okay, I've heard about this story. You mentioned that this as a start to this. You mentioned you being in the middle of Hyderabad, trying to find this mausoleum. What was your research process? Who did you need to speak to? Where did you visit? Tell us all that. But first, if you want, just respond to what I said.
Okay. Well, on what you said, which was very interesting, and I completely agree. I would say that this is a reminder that it's not a simple battle between evil oppressive imperialism on one side and sort of glorious nationalism on the other. And one of the great ironies of 20th century history is that you know these sort of worlds, these princely states, survived imperial rule. They survived the empire, and it was under nationalism that they were destroyed. And even, you know, the Ottoman Caliphate at the end of the day was destroyed by the Turkish Republic. And people will debate over whether, you know, this was a good thing or it was a bad thing. You know, that's not my concern. I'm a historian. But the princely states were destroyed by the new nation states of India and Pakistan. And ironically, the princely states that weren't destroyed were those that went under the protection of the British rather than going to India or Pakistan. So including Qatar, Bahrain, what's now the UAE, and Oman. And they eventually gained their independence. And they survived, but Hyderabad, was vanquished, and there was this. I mean, what are the consequences of the fall of Hyderabad? On the one hand, it's, you know, the dispossession of these princes and princesses, and some of them left to go to England. Generally, they had a pretty good time of it because the Indian government didn't exile them and allowed them to keep their palaces and that sort of thing. But the real consequence was you had the destruction of an entire world. So Hyderabad was invaded by Indian troops. And in the aftermath of the invasion, by a very conservative estimate, about 25,000 people were killed. But that's very conservative. Some estimates put it at, you know, 100,000 people or even more than that. This was just enormous sort of mind-boggling bloodshed. And you had the rounding up of tens of thousands of Arabs living in the state, including those who had been born in Hyderabad, and they were put in detention camps. Some of them were eventually deported by the Indian government. Some of them weren't. Generally, most of them left. You had the destruction of this sort of cosmopolitan world. So imperialism, which was very, oppression was sort of baked into it, was also very cosmopolitan in nature. And modern nationalisms often didn't have time for any of that. So with nationalism, you have the crumbling away or the destruction of these old worlds. Now, as for your question about how I went about researching the book, I started with a dramatic story of looking for the tomb, but that's not how the research started. I eventually got to that point. It began with the archives, so I went to... What's very convenient is that the British Library has the India Office Archives, and there's a sort of vast treasure trove of information in there. So I did a lot of archival research in this country. A friend of mine who's very pro British Empire told me, I told you the British Empire was good for one thing. So that was very convenient. And I did a lot of archival research, and I read Ottoman primary sources. So the memoirs, for example, of an exiled prince, Prince Ali Vasib, it's about his time in Istanbul, and he was a young man when the family was kicked out, and then he eventually ended up in France with the Caliph as well. A lot of these Ottoman exiles were in France. So I studied these Ottoman sources as well as the archival sources. And there were also Urdu language sources. Often they were actually published, but they were just so obscure. So one of the crucial sources is the memoirs of the Nawab of Chattari, who was one of Hyderabad's last prime ministers. And just no one had read people had read these memoirs, but they were incredibly obscure, and they contained all this, you know, extraordinary. I was just reading it, and it's about how I discussed with the Nizam and Prince Azam Jah about whether to bring the caliphate to Hyderabad, and Prince Azam Jah is saying that the Caliph wanted him to be the next Caliph, and the Nizam asked me for my opinion, and I said it's not a good idea. This is incredible stuff, and it was literally just sitting there. And then I went to India. I went to Hyderabad. I toured Hyderabad and saw the palaces and important sites. And then I went to Khuldabad, which is this region in Aurangabad in Maharashtra, which is where the Ottoman mausoleum is. And I should say that although I did say it was in remote India, and it feels very remote while you're there, it's not actually remote. This tomb was built in a very... crucial, significant, politically significant and spiritually significant location. Khuldabad used to be part of Hyderabad, because Hyderabad was this huge state which spanned western and quite a lot of western and southern India. And Khuldabad is also the site of the tomb of Aurangzeb, the famous, much maligned Mughal emperor, who was revered by the 7th Nizam. And it was also the burial place of the 1st Nizam of Hyderabad. And close by is the Daulatabad Fort, which everyone in that region of India knows was the early capital of the Delhi Sultanate, so this medieval Muslim state in India. But it's also considered to be a spiritually significant region by both Muslims and Hindus. So there are lots of shrines of Muslim saints nearby, and there are also the ancient Ellora Caves, which are still a sort of pilgrimage site and a tourist attraction as well in that part of India. And so the tomb was built in this crucial place, and it makes perfect sense when you think about it. It was constructed in the late 1940s, and the Nizam had asked permission from the British to do this. And I found these correspondences between British officials in which they discuss, should we allow this to happen? And their one concern, this was in a letter to the Viceroy of India, so just shows that it went all the way up to the top. The one concern was that it could come out, if this tomb is being built, that the last caliph before he died in 1944 nominated his grandson, Prince Mukarram Jah, to be the next caliph. But then they discuss it and they decide that, you know, we're probably going to be gone in a few years. Mukarram Jah is still a kid. It's a secret that Mukarram Jah is going to be the next Nizam, because officially the next Nizam was going to be Mukarram Jah's father, Azam Jah. But Azam Jah, of course, is not the grandson of the last Ottoman caliph. So they decide, you know what, the Nizam's not going to reveal this. There's a slight risk that the Ottoman princess, Durrashivar, will, but it's okay. And so let them build the tomb. So they actually built the tomb in the final years of British rule, so 1946-47. And then in 1948, work began on a massive complex surrounding the tomb. And then came the fall of Hyderabad and the invasion. And that's why the caliph's body was never brought over. And he wasn't allowed, the Turkish government didn't allow the body to be buried in Turkey, which the family had wanted. And eventually he was buried in 1955 in Medina, in Saudi Arabia.
Okay. So again, I mean, every time you speak, it's just these things that go off. So, you know, you mentioned that these kingdoms were the victims of nationalism in the end. I mean, they were victims of many things, but nationalism kind of does diffuse them. And those that remain kingdoms kind of still have, they more or less intact and are actually socially doing much better than the nations to some extent, right? So I'm going to come back to that. But the British Empire was also a victim of that, right? They're also a victim to colonial, obviously, resistance and nationalism. But, I mean, everyone, I mean, just recently, Tucker Carlson and Piers Morgan had this whole big discussion, which people probably saw, and where Tucker Carlson was basically blaming the fall of the British Empire on wokeism, right, among other things. But, I mean, it's so interesting that nationalism is also what kind of defeated the empire. That's just one observation. I want you to speak more about the research, which I think we're going to start doing too. Tracks your research and just like sort of interesting quirks. The other thing that I found very interesting, I'm losing my train of thought now, but it's coming back, is just how much we kind of have lost by not understanding history, right? So, for example, Hyderabad, you mentioned it's this big province that's almost the size of Italy. Hyderabad's no longer a province now. It has a different name. I think it's Telangana or something of that sort. And it's not much smaller, but it's significantly smaller. And there's this entire rewriting of history. And it's the same in terms of, like, we don't really understand how deeply embedded nation-state thinking is in all of us. And this is for every, I mean, all of us are citizens of one particular country. And fair enough, there's lots of travel, there's lots of cosmopolitanism and you know, multiculturalism, but it just seems like, what's your comments on that? How much have we lost because of, you know, the nation state? We've gained a lot. We've a lot of nations have gained independence and less imperial rule. And it's arguable, as you mentioned, if our lives, depending on which state we're in, is better or not. But just what were the other losses that we had? And I'm not advocating for, you know, return to empires, but just what things were lost?
Well, I think in a lot of Muslim discourse, especially, people look past the 20th century and the early 20th century and even to some extent the 19th century because they see it as a period of failure and decline and it's all very depressing. But actually, this was a period of great dynamism as well. So, you know, in political thought, there was a lot of modernization going on. There were new political experiments. And again, people write off modernization as, oh, they were trying to be like the West. Well, actually, that's not how a lot of the people at this time saw it at all. They they believe they were sort of trying to craft a sort of Muslim modernity. And this story, which I'm writing about, is one of many attempts by certain Muslims to craft a new future for the Muslim world in a kind of in a post-Ottoman age, for the modern world, essentially. But the 20th century, in particular, I would say the early 20th century, saw the fall of a kind of transnational Islamic elite. And so elite classes in different places were dismantled and destroyed and often hounded into exile. And so the connections between them sort of went. And you know, these classes patronized cultural work or intellectual work or artistic work, and certain cities like Istanbul, like Hyderabad, like Lucknow, which were hubs and which attracted all these thinkers to them, they sort of went away. And then in the case of India, what partition did is it carved up, so it created a new Muslim state, Pakistan, but it also represented the carving up of the Indo-Islamic world. Now, the alternative, the most popular alternative vision to partition, which was actually very popular, was for an Indian federation. So what Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the leader of the Muslim League and founder of Pakistan, agreed to in 1946 was an Indian federation, and you'd have Pakistan within India. So there'd be Pakistan and essentially what he saw as Hindustan, and it would be within India, and he wouldn't, you wouldn't renounce the Indian identity, and the subcontinent and India would still be one thing. Now, people can argue about whether that would have descended into civil war or not. Although I should say that partition...
Civil war happened anyway,
what
kind
was
of.
Was partition,
yes,
except yeah. Civil war, you know? But that was this very significant alternative vision. And what I'm talking about, the scheme for an Indian caliphate, was a vision within that scheme. So the idea was that, you know, in an Indian federation, Hyderabad could be, the princely states would be autonomous. And so Hyderabad could be a very powerful, autonomous, modernizing princely state. And given the right conditions, you could have a Nizam in Hyderabad who also claimed sort of soft power in the Muslim world. And you can imagine India, the Indian subcontinent, was the place with the largest number of Muslims in the world. And it had that status. And it was seen as Indian thinkers viewed this very interestingly, not just Muslim thinkers, but Hindu thinkers as well. And this is actually something I want to emphasize, that pan-Islamic politics in India it was something that Hindus as well as Muslims participated in, including Gandhi in the 1920s and including some thinkers who would later be Hindu nationalists, because they believed that the politics of pan-Islam, of sort of, transnational Muslim solidarity, was a way that India could be extremely significant in the world, and also an important means of anti-colonial solidarity. So Islam performed the same function for them that, you know, communism or ideas of internationalism would later play. So that was why the Congress Party, which was Hindu-dominated, and not just the Muslim League, were central to the Khilafat movement in support of the Ottomans. So you have, and these things are largely forgotten, this kind of Indo-Islamic history in the 20th century, and it ended with partition. And you had the fall of Hyderabad, you had the migration of lots of Indian Muslim elites to Pakistan, and you also had, obviously, the opposite. Pakistan could never take on the same role as a sort of Indian federation could take within the Islamic world, because it wasn't large enough, and it was a sort of smaller, more vulnerable neighbour to India. And then it broke apart itself into Pakistan and Bangladesh. But what's interesting is that India tried to join the Organization of Islamic Cooperation multiple times, and Pakistan blocked it each time. But the grounds on which India wanted to join is because they had such a large Muslim population. So all of this has been forgotten. largely forgotten in the kind of public consciousness, and these kind of transnational connections were often destroyed by the rise of nationalisms and the fall of empires, and so that's what this book is really trying to look at.
Okay, I mean, I'm gonna ask you about a few characters who you may have interviewed in the course of putting this book together and some of their interesting life stories. But before we get there, if you look at, I mean, so the empire, people who think about the global perspective. So there's this point where the United Kingdom is the most powerful nation on earth. It controls or occupies or has sovereignty over about 25% of the world's landmass, and probably more than that in terms of human population. And then after World War One, and definitely after World War Two, you know, America becomes the big person on the block, and you have what's post-imperial. And just when you look at the Muslim world in particular, we can't obviously deal with all of it, but in the Arab states, by and large, for the last, you know, since then, there's been independence, which was followed by kings or dictators who are often seen as dictators. There's been a bloc, which is anti-imperial, which is also, it doesn't start off like that. It starts off as kind of anti-imperial with Mossadegh in Iran, but then becomes pro-imperial under a king, the Shah, and is now anti-imperial. And that entire sort of Iranian bloc, which now Syria is no longer a part of, but kind of was. And then we know what's happened with India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, and just from the Muslim perspective. And, in India, the Muslim population is significantly weakened. Hindu nationalism has changed a lot radically. And Pakistan is a weakened state, as is Bangladesh, right? So we have this post-imperial situation. Not to say that the life of the average citizen who was Muslim or not was fantastic under British rule. But what's your comments? How would you compare current post-imperialism with, you know, British imperialism at its height, maybe in 1850 or 1800?
Well, I would say,
from the perspective of, if you are subject of this empire and you have pan-national or pan-Muslim or pan-citizen, you know, aspirations.
Well, I think you had the peak of pan-Islamic politics, and now that's heavily declined. And pan-Islamic politics were always going to be easier in an age of empires, because you had these massive sprawling empires, and identities were less, you know, clearly defined as well in a world of empires. In nation states, it's very different. And even people who claim to be sort of pan-Islamists today, usually they are actually thinking about their particular
country,
nation state. Whereas if you're a Muslim under the British Empire, you know, not just in India, but also perhaps in the Middle East, you're going to have far wider horizons just because of the scope of the empire. And one interesting way to look at this is to think about Palestine. Now, a significant part of this story, which I haven't spoken about yet, is Palestine, because there was a congress in 1931 in Jerusalem called the World Islamic Congress, which effectively, this was the moment that the Palestinian struggle became recognized for the first time as a global pan-Islamic and a pan-Arab struggle. Now, the Congress was organized by Maulana Shaukat Ali, the architect of this scheme for an Indian caliphate, and it was organized with Caliph Abdul Majid II. And it was 1931, and their plan was that the last Ottoman caliph, now deposed, will come over to Jerusalem and address a meeting of Muslim leaders and notables from across the world, and this would rally support for the Ottoman caliphate. And this would be in Jerusalem, which until very recently was in Ottoman hands. But Turkish spies got wind of the situation, and the British banned the caliph from entering Palestine, so the plan failed. But the Congress went ahead, and it had very significant implications. So this was a sort of the peak, as I say, of pan-Islamic politics, and Palestine was a very important part of that. And we often assume that Palestine was always considered to be this kind of great pan-Islamic cause. But actually, before that, it wasn't. And Palestinian leaders wanted to encourage Muslim interest from elsewhere in the Palestinian struggle against the British mandate and against dispossession and occupation. But it only really came to be in the 1930s. And then after that, you had, you know, the Arab revolt. So there is this kind of this history of very easy, kind of fluid, transnational Muslim politics in this period, which was lost after that. And I think we tend to forget that when we think about history in terms of empire bad and then gaining freedom. Well, actually, I think this is widely recognized in the Indian subcontinent, to be honest, that, you know, gaining freedom, that process was very bloody. Decolonization was extremely, extremely violent. I mean, if you look at Hyderabad, about three times the number of people who were ethnically cleansed during the Palestinian Nakba were displaced in Hyderabad. And that was just Hyderabad. So the partition was partition and its long-lasting consequences were absolutely extraordinary. And it wasn't this kind of like nice, peaceful process at all. And so if you had been, if you'd been a peasant in Hyderabad, your life would probably have improved greatly 30 years on. Or maybe not, because, you know, there was economic growth was not always great. But for a lot of people, life actually got much worse. And so history has these kinds of sort of weird fluctuations, and there are kind of ambiguities and things that we often think of, you know, this must have been good. For many people, it wasn't. And also, we shouldn't necessarily, in my view, look at like the history of empires as being good or bad. Like, oh, the British Empire was bad and what came after it was good. I mean, let's study the empire as it was with all its ambiguities and contradictions. We often think of the British as having like a unified imperial discourse and view of colonized peoples. That wasn't true at all. We often think of the British as having sort of used ideas about Islam in order to kind of control Muslims within the empire. That's true. But also Muslim thinkers within the empire had their own agency. And what people turn around and say often is that these nationalist figures and even, you know, Muslim League politicians or Congress politicians, they were westernized and they were influenced by the West. And then they came into power and they instituted Western ideas. But this, to me, it's true to an extent. But this like removes agency from these people, that if you just talk about them as being like and also from people like princes who sort of made the best of their situation and did everything to protect their own power. These are agents of their own, and everyone had different interests. The interests of the Nizam of Hyderabad were not the same as the interests of Muhammad Ali Jinnah or of Jawaharlal Nehru or Gandhi. Like, and these are just the elite players. So history is far more complex than we often think.
Okay, absolutely, history is a lot more complex. I just want to say, because just in case people are misinterpreting, you're not. And I think a good way to think about this is, it's not really comparing empire politics to, you know, post-empire nationalist politics. They both sort of are happening under the guise of a colonial world, a world where people who originate out of Europe are exercising sovereignty over the world. I mean, in this case, it includes the USA, as seeing them as part of the West or Europeans. And I think this is what's interesting. It's that for subjects, and bear in mind, you know, even 1,000 years ago when people were in charge of their own, you know, depended on the king. If the king could have been a tyrant, your life was not very good. Mm-hmm. If the king was merciful and great, that's different. Obviously, people being subject to being subjects of empire has created otherization. It's been the increase of racism, potentially, but definitely, you know, in terms of the slave trade, those kind of things where, you know, and especially the colorism around being lighter skinned meant that your life would probably be better than being darker skinned. So I think, but I mean, it's not a defense of colonialism or empire. It's just that both were horrible periods, and history is a lot more complex and a lot more interesting. And how your life may have been, whether it was a British-inspired famine or, you know, the horrors of partition, often just wasn't, I mean, I hate to use this term, but almost an accident of history, in addition to the fact that there has been this massive, horrible colonial project, which is still living through the sort of aftermath of that. Now to the figures in your book, right? We'll probably return back to observations.
I completely agree. And it's not, I'm not trying to launder empire.
Yes.
I'm trying to complicate ideas of post-colonial history.
No, absolutely. I think it's important to launder. I was doing the same. Okay, so tell me about the characters in the book that you've spoken to, that you interviewed. I'm just from what you've said, I've read some of the book, not all of it, and obviously I've spoken to you about it, but it's already so intriguing. But tell me more things that will stand out for people who are going to go and get the book, The Indian Caliphate by Imran Walla.
Well, generally the main players in the book are all dead. And if I had written this book 20 years ago, a lot of them would have been alive and very old. But actually, even sort of just 6 years ago, I mean, Prince Mukarram Jah, who had been, who was the grandson of Caliph Abdul Majid on his mother's side and of the Nizam on his father's side, he passed away only in 2023. So in an apartment in Istanbul, where he lived in complete anonymity and none of his neighbors really knew who he was. So it's extraordinary. But someone I did interview was...
Mukarram Jah, just to clarify, he's the guy who was tapped to be the heir of the Ottomans in Hyderabad.
Yes, exactly, yeah. I interviewed Princess Kenize Murad. She's known as Kenize Murad generally because she's a very distinguished writer. She's written multiple novels and also she's a journalist. She's now in her 80s, but she is a princess. And her story is absolutely fascinating and is part of the story of this book. Her parents, so her mother... was Princess Salma, another Ottoman princess who was exiled from Istanbul and actually ended up in Beirut rather than in Europe. And her father was the Raja of Gotwara, so another Indian prince. And this guy was educated in Edinburgh. He went to Edinburgh University rather than Oxford because Princess Kenize told me this. Oxford didn't allow students to have cars in their first year, and he loved cars. But he was a fascinating guy because he was a communist, an avowed communist, despite being a king. A prince. But this was actually more common than you think. And he was a strong supporter of the Congress Party and actually did very well in India after the fall of the princely order because of his position as a Congress politician. So the Raja of Gotwara was also an ally of Maulana Shaukat Ali, who was the Indian politician who had brokered the original marriage between the Ottoman Caliph's daughter and the Nizam's son. So now he was known as the go-to guy. If you want to sort of join, have a marriage between an Ottoman royal and an Indian prince.
So he was hooking up these marriages in addition to doing a bunch of other things.
Yes. So for Princess Salma, the Indian princes were wealthy, and this was a future for these exiled royals, is to join another royal family.
Who usually had a lot of wealth,
and India again was seen as important. And I think people might find it odd today, and certainly from my conversations, that why would these Ottomans want to sort of hitch themselves to India? But India, they really were seen as incredibly important.
And this is India after 200 years of British rule.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. But it was seen as just central to everything. And for the Raja of Gotwara, it was also seen as it was going to be very good for his status as an Indian Muslim politician to have an Ottoman wife. So she married him, and although he was very progressive and not especially devout, she still had to abide by the strictures of the court in this princely state, and she didn't like that at all because she'd grown up relatively free in Beirut. And so she went to France in order to have her baby, accompanied only by a eunuch, and she had the baby, Princess Kenize, in Paris during World War II, and then she passed away shortly after.
So she travelled to France before World War II started?
Yes. Okay. And then she had the baby during World War II. She passed away of sepsis, and Princess Kenizé ended up in a convent being raised by nuns. Then after World War II ended, the Raja sent people over to France to go and find the baby and bring her back to him. But when the convent got wind of this, they couldn't countenance the idea of handing this lovely, sweet little girl over to a Muslim prince, which they thought was sort of, an evil idea to do.
A Mohammedan prince.
A Mohammedan prince, exactly. And so they hid her. And so Princess Kenizé, who could have been raised as a princess in India, in the end was raised as a Christian, as a nun in the convent. And she had an extraordinary life. But she told me that it was very difficult for her growing up because she had been told all sorts of lies about, who her family was and why her father hadn't come to get her. And it was when she was a teenager that she started to discover her past. She discovered Islam. She finally, at the age of 20, I believe, went to India and met her father for the first time. And I think on that trip, she also met Prime Minister Nehru of India, who was obviously a friend of her father. And then she connected with some of the other Ottoman exiles, including Princess Niloufer, another princess who was married to the younger son of the Nizam of Hyderabad. But she said this was like a great sort of identity. She was trying to find her identity because she'd grown up as a French woman. And she is very much a French woman. And she became a distinguished left-wing journalist, and then a novelist, and she wrote a novel based on the life of her mother, and she was the darling of France's literary establishment until she chose to write a book about that most politically incorrect of topics, Palestine, which didn't prove very popular in the French literary establishment. And after that, she was effectively boycotted, and her recent books have basically been boycotted. No one will review them. She doesn't really go on French TV anymore. And she told me that she very recently moved from France to Turkey and is now living in Turkey because she'd had enough of the anti-Palestinian and anti-Muslim sentiment in France. So absolutely extraordinary. Her mother was exiled from Turkey 100 years ago, and now she's moved back to Turkey. So this is the wheel of history.
Okay, so she was born in World War II, so she's probably like in her 80s now?
In her 80s, yeah.
Okay, and did she go, I think you did mention, but she went back to India, like once she discovered this, and then she lived in Hyderabad for a while.
She didn't live in Hyderabad.
Okay.
She was a journalist, and she moved all over the world, and she lived in France for most of her life. But she was heavily engaged with South Asia.
She didn't go back to like live with her family for a while. She just became acquainted with them.
And also remember that the princely order by the time she went back was destroyed. Like obviously her father still had a lot of prestige, and because he was a big figure in the Congress as well. But that world was gone. And you have to, when you think about some of these people, like even Princess Durrashivar, who married the Nizam's son, she was exiled from Istanbul at the age of 10, lived in exile in France, then moved to Hyderabad. And then that Hyderabad fell and she moved to London and lived in and eventually died in London. So these people had lives of exile and not being able to go back home. Princess Durrashivar, I believe, eventually managed to go back to Turkey because Turkey stopped Ottoman royals from going back for about 50 years, I think. But Durrashivar eventually went back as an Indian princess. So not as an Ottoman princess, but as an Indian princess, she was allowed to go. And she went to ask the Turkish prime minister to allow her father's body to be buried in Istanbul. And he said no. So these exiled royals had extraordinary, often very rich, very interesting lives, but I think very tragic as well.
I think it's part of the accident of being born in a time where empires are falling, but certainly very, very interesting. I mean, when you mention this, there's just so much stuff in here, Imran. I mean, you could probably have a really good short biography of Princess Kenizé, and I'm sure it will fly off the shelves. I mean, if probably live in a different world, so I'm not sure it will fly over the showers, but I was just listening to you. It's just because I remember reading about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and nation states coming into existence, and the story, exactly what you said, the story was, you know, there was this guy, Abdul Majid. Most people forget his name. They know Abdul Hamid. But they forget his name.
They think Abdul Hamid was the final one.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And then this guy just got shipped off by Ataturk to go to France or somewhere and lived in a villa quietly. And it's clear that he was operating. He was trying what he can. It's very personal also. He's also like, it's personal ambition tied to it. It's not necessarily, you know, grandiose ideas of some massive revival, but he was definitely an operator.
I think it was that as well. I think it was both.
Both, yeah. Exactly. It's an operator. And again, that's a book on itself, the life of Abdul Majid. And the other character, and I'm sure there's many, but someone that's really standing out to me is this guy, Maulana Shaukat Ali.
Yes.
Tell us more about him.
One of the most extraordinary figures of recent Indian history. Maulana Shaukat Ali, he's usually known together with his brother. They're the Ali brothers. And they are actually very famous. So his younger brother, Maulana Muhammad Ali, died in 1930, actually. So just before all this happened.
So there were three of them?
Two. Ali brothers.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Shaukat, the elder, and Muhammad Ali, the younger. Both of them studied at Aligarh, the kind of modernist Muslim university. Muhammad Ali went to Oxford as well, as many you know, future Indian politicians did. But
as Gandhi did.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. These two figures were known as firstly they were close friends of Gandhi during the between 1918 or so and the 1920s. They were the leaders of the Khilafat movement, and the Khilafat movement, we have to remember, it's often sort of looked down upon as some kind of sort of weird superstitious movement of Muslims, but it was actually grounded in sort of very real demands against the European occupation of Anatolia, and there were serious connections between the Turks and the Khilafatists in India, among them Hindus, obviously. The Khilafat movement in India was really the only mass anti-colonial mobilization. It was certainly the first one, and it was the birth of the movement for Indian independence. It was the forerunner to the movements that came afterwards, and it was during the Khilafat movement that Gandhi put his civil disobedience ideas sort of into practice on an Indian-wide stage. And this was sort of pan-Indian politics. So the Ali brothers were these incredible figures who everyone knew them. And they were sort of, Maulana Shaukat Ali was also known for being very, very tall and very large. Maulana Muhammad Ali was known as the great speaker, and his speeches were like extremely witty, and he was hilarious as well. And they were modernist thinkers, sort of very deep thinkers, very, very pluralistic as well. And they helped change Indian history. But today, They're remembered in India, but as sort of, you know, the Khilafatists, and they were friends with Gandhi, and then they went to the Muslim League. They're remembered in Pakistan as heroes and sort of part of the Pakistan movement, although they weren't. Actually, because this was before the Pakistan idea really took hold. Maulana Shaukat Ali died in 1938. So he was, this was 2 years before the demand for the Muslim League demanded Pakistan. But he did work with the Muslim League in his final years, you know, as a close ally of Muhammad Ali Jinnah. As is often the case with South Asian historical figures, they're lionized and they're remembered as heroes or as villains, but the actual complexities of the people themselves and their friends and their enemies and how they thought about the world are completely forgotten. But you could also say the same about Sir Muhammad Iqbal and these other figures who are often held up as a great heroes, but no one really knows sort of much about them. Academics write about them, of course, but in the public consciousness, it's not understood who they were.
I mean, it's maybe their names are mentioned, but just exactly their politics and their ideas is not exactly translated. You mentioned he was sort of like a modernist sort of Islamic thinker. What does that mean?
Well, he was trying to find... So he wanted a revived Ottoman caliphate. But this wasn't... It would be a mistake to think of this as some kind of traditionalist restorationist movement. What he envisioned, which is also what Abdul Majid himself envisioned, was a kind of modern caliphate for a post-Ottoman age in which the, you know, it's an Ottoman caliphate without an Ottoman empire, essentially. And his was the politics of pan-Islamic connections and alliances that went across imperial and national borders. And this was a very modern thing. What's interesting about this period, and Shokhrat Ali exemplifies this, is that this was a time at which the Islamic world existed more than it ever had before, in the sense that it was more connected than it ever had. I mean, in the medieval period, there was a sense of, you know, a Muslim ummah, for example, but people wouldn't be reading newspapers yes. about something that was going on across the world. You had Indians who were clamoring about atrocities that were taking place in Anatolia. I mean, this sort of thing was unimaginable 200 years before that. So now more than ever, there was an idea of an Islamic world and also of an Indian Muslim identity. There was an idea of that in a way that there simply hadn't been.
And there's
before.
A common cause because yeah. most of these places are fighting some form of colonialism.
Yes, exactly. So it's often very anti-colonial. And Shokhrat Ali and Muhammad Ali are rightly remembered as anti-colonial figures. I mean, they were imprisoned by the British for their pro-Khilafat agitations. There was a famous trial in Karachi where they were put on trial for things that they had written because they were sort of journalists. And they refused to stand for the judge. So then when their chairs were taken away so they'd have to stand, they sat on the floor instead. And then they made these grand proclamations in the court that this was a battle between, this was God versus man, and we're not going to give away our souls to the British. We're devoted to our faith. And Maulana Muhammad Ali passed away in London at the 1930 Round Table Conference, which was a failed attempt to bring Indian politicians together to thrash out a new constitutional arrangement for India. And his final speech, which he gave, at which there were lots of kind of British lords and politicians present, he declared, you know, he outlined his vision for an Indian federation. He discussed how people say that, you know, Muslims are not loyal to India. Well, actually, he said, we belong to both worlds, India and the Muslim world, and we can leave neither. So, and where India is concerned, you know, I'm an Indian first and foremost. And then finally, he ended his speech by declaring that I will not go back to a slave country. Either you give India freedom or I'm not going to go back there, and you'll have to bury me here. And then shortly afterwards, he was very ill and he passed away in London. But he wasn't buried in London. The Mufti of Jerusalem at the time asked for him to be buried there because he was such a significant figure. And so his body was taken to Jerusalem and he was buried, I believe, in the Al-Aqsa compound.
Okay. You know, often one can gauge the impact of what we're discussing by who's going to be most offended, right? So, for example, most of the conversations I have on the show is probably going to offend Zionists, right? because often I've been hosting the show and there's genocide occurring, obviously we speak about that. I did a show a while back where we discussed the UAE's interference in the Middle East, and I'm guessing the people most upset about that are allies or friends of the UAE elite. People listening to this conversation, and maybe you can rank them, who do you think, I mean, because it's a, and why I'm asking the question, because it's kind of, it's a good indication of how the world has changed since the time you're writing this book, right? So who do you think is going to be most offended? And maybe there's a list of groups of people. And I don't want to categorize people, but just, you know, in your mind, who's going to be most offended if they were listening to this conversation?
Well, I should hope that people aren't offended, but I know that I assume that they will be.
I'm sure I've seen your Twitter profile since you've talked about this book, so I think people will be offended.
There is a lot of disagreement.
Yes, let's
say. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that a lot of people in India these days, India's changed a lot, and what this book is really trying to say is that the subcontinent has, you know, many different identities or layers to its, layers to its identity, dimensions to its identity. And one of those is its Indo-Islamic history, which is not just the history of invasion and oppression, but is also the history of people actually in India and who are Indian and Hindus and Muslims getting along. And so this speaks to that history. And so you can imagine that people, for example, like the current Hindu nationalist establishment in India might not want to emphasize this kind of historical Indo-Islamic identity, and so they wouldn't like that. But then I think lots of other people in the subcontinent hopefully will appreciate what this is trying to say, and it's not about a kind of Islamic invasion or an Ottoman invasion of India. It's not that at all. But I think more interestingly, some other disagreement I've seen has come from people elsewhere in the Islamic world who are not too fond of the idea of India as kind of central to the Islamic world and think it's like a crazy idea. Like, why would the last Ottoman caliph have wanted to sort of have the future of his line in India? And I should say it's quite important to say there is like ambiguity to this story. Like, you never really know what people actually thought and what conversations were never written down.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
What people said behind closed doors. And it's important to say that. Like, we still don't know what exactly the Nizam of Hyderabad thought of this plan and whether he wanted Hyderabad to be the seat of the caliphate. Like many people have said that, yes, he did, and there are sources to suggest that, but it's not definitive. And there's even ambiguity over what exactly the last caliph wanted. But it's fair to say it's certainly the case that the union, the marital union, was a political union, and the caliph made it a condition of the union that the firstborn son of the marriage will be Nizam of Hyderabad. So he was looking for a future for his line, and there's considerable evidence that he wanted the caliphate to be revived with Hyderabad as its seat. So people will sort of focus in on that and quibble over that. I recently interviewed for the book a man named Shahid Hussain Zubairi, who was a close confidant of Prince Mukarram Jah for many years and managed his estate and knew him better than almost anyone else. And he told me that Mukarram Jah himself told him that the caliph had designated him as his successor in the caliphate, and that this was the idea behind the union, and the Nizam went along with it, and also liked this idea, and that's very plausible, but it's not documented. So I fully expect people to sort of challenge these details and wonder about these details and debate over them, and that's a good thing. That's, you know, this historical debate is excellent, but what I do also notice is that people can't get their head around the idea of the Ottomans looking at India and thinking this place is important. And that's because it's not seen as such today. But what I think this is part of the importance of this book, hopefully, is that we need to understand that if you sort of go back 100 years, India was actually seen, the subcontinent was seen as the epicenter of the Islamic world. And there is a lot of sometimes like a bit of prejudice or bigotry. Sometimes it's grounded in just the fact that, you know, no one actually sees the subcontinent as being central to the Islamic world today. But it did have this role. And if there's anything that I want this history to remind sort of people in countries like Turkey of, it's that the subcontinent was important, and there were these links, there were these ties between the subcontinent and the Middle East that were often very intimate, you know, often literally sort of intimate family ties, and so it's a call to look past narrow nationalist readings of history and see the world and global history as much more kind of interconnected and cosmopolitan than we might often assume.
Okay. Just some analysis to what you just said. I mean, if you go back to the period 1800 to, 1930, which by then, the Abdul-Majid is in France, there's really four powers in the Muslim world. There's Istanbul, and I'm just talking about the capital. There's Istanbul, there's Cairo, I don't know what was the capital at the time of the Safavid dynasty in Iran, and then there's the Mughal Empire, right? And so, I mean, it can't be Cairo because that was a subject of the Ottoman Empire, and by then it's firmly in the hands of British colonialism, and it's an option, but they haven't made the extension. But the thing is, under Muhammad Ali of Egypt, there's been contention with the Ottoman Empire for a while. The Persian Empire at the time, it's always been in competition with the Ottomans, and it's also Shia Islam versus, I mean, not that I think I'm overplaying the Shia hand, but that is a factor, the fact that this is the heart of Shia Islam, whereas the Ottomans were seen as the seat of Sunni Islam. And so the Mughal Empire, or its remnants, in this case the Nizam of Hyderabad, it does seem like a natural successor. And a place where there could be a mutual alliance. I'm not saying that, India wasn't important and this place wasn't important, but there's a bunch of other accidents of history that make this, which I think you would not disagree with, hence no, I'm not really pushing
absolutely.
It.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is not to make a kind of chauvinistic pro-Indian argument. Look how great this continent is. It's more just that there are these facts about history that we forget.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's important to be reminded of them and to be reminded of, links that existed and that sort of thing. So okay.
Because I know you, I knew you would, I just was kind of
What I would say about the Mughal Empire as well, it's a very good point you make, is that the Mughals didn't care that much about the Ottomans and their claims to ruling the Islamic world, because the Mughal Empire was more populous than the Ottoman Empire and wealthier for most of its history than the Ottoman Empire. Of course, it also lasted for not as long as the Ottoman Empire, but the Mughals were sort of very important in their own right. But there was a kind of a Persianate cultural interaction between all of these empires, and a kind of elites would read the same books, and Indian poets who wrote in Persian, like Amir Khusro, would be read in the Ottoman Empire by elites there, and vice versa. Books written by Indian ulama would be read in the Ottoman Empire, vice versa as well. The world was much more interconnected than we tend to think of, although generally that was at the more elite level. I think what was different about the modern period is that the world was much smaller in a sense, because you could sort of send telegrams and communicate sort of quickly.
Absolutely.
And people could easily get to other places. So and figures like Shaukat Ali and they were like moving around. They were in London, and then they were in France, and then in Hyderabad and Bombay, and so you really had this kind of, everyone was effectively closer together.
Shaukat Ali, he's very different, but he reminds me of, I think you've heard the episode as well. I spoke to John Esposito about 7 months ago, and I was interviewing him about him explaining the history of the Islamic sort of pan-colonial movement. And he doesn't even mention Shaukat Ali, but he mentions Afghani as the central figure, and it's even then it's absolutely true, because there's two intellectual hubs that Afghani really tries to see to. He visits Istanbul, he visits he visits Tehran,
and visited Hyderabad.
Exactly. So this is what I'm saying. Yeah, and it's almost like there's this he kind of starts this revivalist movement, you could say, across the ex-Ottoman Empire, not even the Arab world, right? Because it includes Istanbul, and then in India it's Sayyid Amir Ali and Shaukat, and he goes and he tries to make this bridge, as Shaukat Ali was also trying to make this bridge. So it goes to see that this really was a central sort of part of the world. An observation I want to make: you mentioned that Shaukat Ali and Muhammad Ali were at Aligarh University, and then I think it was only Shaukat who was at Oxford, or both.
Muhammad Ali was
right.
At Oxford, yeah.
You mentioned earlier on the guy who was studying in Edinburgh, the Raja of
Gurdwara,
right? Gandhi was at Oxford. I think Nehru was a graduate of Aligarh.
Cambridge.
Cambridge.
So Nehru was at Cambridge Trinity, and Iqbal was also at Trinity.
Right. Absolutely. Sayyid Amir Ali's Aligarh, and I mean it's all these colonial institutions. In South Africa, Nelson Mandela and Oliver Tambo and Walter Sisulu were at Fort Hare, which was the British-built university for black people in South Africa. Not more or less the same time, slightly after, because they're slightly younger. Kemal Ataturk went to Roberts College in, again, a British colonial institution, which was there too. And I mean, other members of, you know, people who become officers in the Young Turks or become the first sort of ministers or important figures or writers in you know, modern Turkey. It's interesting how these colonial schools that are set up to extend empire in one way or the other and to educate, you know, people, become these places where the independents or the revolutionaries or those who are pushing against empire sort of coalesce. What's your comments on that?
It's a fascinating point. I call them the anglicized radicals. It's a chapter in my book, I think. It's the anglicized radicals. I mean, it actually makes sense because you know, there was a move to allow people from elsewhere in the empire to come and study, elites from elsewhere in the empire to study, or there's sometimes middle class people in the metropole in order to sort of train them to be the kind of administrators and to sort of handle the empire for the British. And so that's why a lot of people went to Oxford, for example, or Cambridge. But then what actually happened is that these figures, they came, they were educated in Britain, people like Muhammad Ali, they could speak perfect English and they could wax lyrical about Shakespeare and they saw themselves as... They were friends with English people, with you know, their English classmates. And often they realized they were cleverer than this guy. And, you know, this guy's really clever. And they saw themselves as equals with these people. And they imbibed British ideas of tolerance and fair play and decency. And then they thought, hold on, we're equals. We should be treated as equals. And we're learning all these ideas and they're not being implemented in our home countries. And now we have a good sense of how to actually argue for that. And we can also talk to the people who are ruling us as equals. And we believe we're on equal terms with them. And there's another factor, which is that you had Indians from all over India and people from elsewhere in the empire who were meeting each other at these places. And so it was the growth of the consciousness of a kind of a pan-Indian identity because they were people from the south, people from the north. They were meeting in a debating society in Cambridge or in Oxford. And actually, the Secretary of State for India in the early 20th century got so scared about this that he introduced a rule at Cambridge that a college could only allow, I think, like two Indians a year, because he was getting so scared that we have the growth of this extremism within the Cambridge colleges, that all these Indians are coming and they're all getting together and they nurse fanatical beliefs that they're going to drive us out of India, which is, of course, exactly what eventually happened. So this is one of the great stories of history. I wouldn't see them as, you can look at it in a kind of condescending way that, look, they imbibed British ideas and they were taught by the British and that's why they, you know, overthrew the British and they are essentially westernized. But no, they had their own agency and they melded their own ideas and their own identities with, you know, their sense of being British subjects or their rejection eventually of being British subjects and things that they learned. And they tried to forge a new future. So yeah. It's an extraordinary story.
Now, I mean, just to come back on your point, absolutely agree. But I think, and I mean, you mentioned that people, you know, there's this patronizing way that these guys are westernized. But from my own reading of some of these people's biographies and or like some semi-biographies or insights, it's very much like the immigrant experience in a way where they definitely gain the confidence, as you mentioned, because they speak the language and they can wax lyrical about Shakespeare, etc. But just like how immigrants feel otherized, they also have these minor otherizations. And they already had it before they get there because they're obviously seen as subjects of the empire. And it goes to show that you can't really get the, you know, that sense of I am a subject to some other empire out of one. And it's just, I mean, and I think this is the core thing. It's definitely that aspect. Because I personally used to like maybe emphasize that whole they gain the confidence kind of thing. But I think in the last 5 or 6 years, and maybe it's a result of what's happening in the world, I'm starting to see that it's a lot about you can't actually get the natural urge for a human to want to claim their dignity and resist. And it's more like they find themselves empowered and then they're like, it's an accident of history. I'm actually the only one, or me and my colleagues, we are best placed to actually lead this. And so let's go and do it.
It's a very good point, because, like, I mean, in French Algeria, you had a lot of settlers. You didn't have that in India. The fact is, most Indians, like, didn't encounter white British people. They just didn't. And people often, you know, talk about how there were white-only kind of clubs in India. But, like, it's like, these were tiny. There were barely any of them. It's not, like, a major
phenomenon.
The average
person didn't know.
Yeah. It was these elites who were going, and then they would experience discrimination and racism, and they would see some of that. And you're right, this alienation was very important, very powerful. Although, like, Maulana Muhammad Ali had... by the way, I should add this, actually, that I'm calling them Maulanas. They weren't jurists, but they were... During the Khilafat movement, they were given the title Maulana by the Firangi Mahal.
So they didn't go and study...
They were given the honorary title of Maulana during the Khilafat movement. They were, obviously, philosophers and great thinkers. Muhammad Ali... He later wrote about this and spoke about this, about Oxford's drinking culture, and how everyone would sort of constantly drink in the hall. And what he used to do is he would drink but not swallow. so he'd sort of get around it somehow. And he spoke about, you know, how he and his Muslim friend would sometimes try and fast. And one time they wanted to pray, but then they didn't. Firstly, there were pictures with eyes on them everywhere, so they had to cover them, and then they had to find the direction of prayer, and then by the end of it they were just like laughing so much that they gave up. So he had all these kind of experiences of being, you know, away from home, away from India, that strengthened his idea, strengthened his sense of being Indian and also of being Muslim, I think. But he didn't feel, he always harbored this kind of great affection for Britain as well. And Shaukat Ali said that if I was told in a battle to kill Theodore Beck, the old master at Ulagar, I wouldn't be able to do it. I couldn't bring myself to do it. And he would tease Muhammad Ali for being always affectionate towards Oxford. And there was a great, I forget his name, there was another Indian freedom fighter who was in British prison once. And it was the day of the Oxford-Cambridge boat race. So he asked the prison guards to put the boat race on the radio so that he could listen to it, because he remembered his Cambridge days so fondly. So he had all the great stories.
Yeah. I mean, when you mentioned the Viceroy banned the amount of Indians who are going to go to various colleges, I mean, it's almost similar to now what you're seeing with education. I mean, it's not really, it's not like that. It's not the same, but it's definitely, there's definitely similarities between what's happening with the Trump administration and, you know, they kind of upset that there's all of these anti-colonial scholars at Columbia University, and there's new quotas been set up, not just, you know, to study the arts and politics, but on sciences and all these kind of things. And you can see that this is just the nature of you know, people trying to hold on to receding sort of parts of the empire. We don't have much time left. It's been a lovely discussion. Before we kind of get to the closing sort of part of this, just, you've educated me in this discussion. You've educated, I guess, people listening, and I'm sure people who read the book, and I definitely do myself, want to read the whole thing from cover to cover. I've read parts of it. But you yourself, I mean, you obviously have learned a lot, but if there's one thing you've learned which stands out to you, and you may have mentioned it already, but you know, if you could think back, you know, Imran, who started writing this book 2 years ago with enthusiasm, excited by the subject matter, before you actually start your research and put it together, what's that thing that you've learned?
I think that people often don't like to encounter bizarre contradictions in history or in historical figures, and they find it strange, like the idea of an Islamic caliph who's a painter.
And what is he painting?
Music. He painted all sorts, you know. Often, when he was younger, he actually painted Orientalist-style paintings of naked women, for example. So not that wasn't much of his work, but, you know, he did that as well. And sort of some people were scandalized by that when they discovered this.
And this is while he was living in like Topkapi.
it wasn't in Topkapi, but in one of the palaces. Yes. Yeah. While he was a young prince. And he eventually, I mean, he was always a painter. He painted more sort of authentic depictions of harem life later on. He has a great painting called Beethoven in the Harem, which depicts him and his family playing music in the harem. But people often sort of would react with, you know, what the hell is this? So absolutely bizarre. Or they're just confused by it. And the Nizam, they would say, oh, is this like a British puppet? Or, you know, a Muslim tyrant? Or it's kind of anachronistic that he's this princely state in British India. And people also often can't compute the idea of an Ottoman caliph wanting to continue his line in India and his grandson being half Hyderabadi. But these apparent contradictions can often be very coherent. So the Ottoman caliph Abdul Majid II actually believed that his work and his artistic inclinations were completely compatible with Islam, and he called for the ulama to reform so that they would allow the painting of living figures. And he strongly believed that. People can agree with him or disagree with him, but he saw himself as a people often say this, that, oh, he wasn't a pious Muslim, and that's why you know, people didn't like him, and that contributed to the caliphate being abolished. This was nonsense. He saw himself as a very devoted Muslim and as a European Ottoman Muslim as well. These extraordinary contradictions that maybe are not actually contradictions or are coherent contradictions are sort of the most interesting thing that I've discovered.
I can definitely see people. If I mean, I doubt they would have gotten this far into this podcast, but I can definitely see that the people out there saying, "So the Ottoman Khilafah fell because this man was painting naked women."
Yes.
Well, that will be clipped up and put out. Okay. Look, I mean, thanks. This has been a lovely discussion. If you are listening to this, clearly you can see that this is a very interesting piece of work. I do agree, because I read parts of it where you mentioned that this is an unknown or more or less unknown story, or less, you know, less known story, I should say, than unknown story. And absolutely agree with that.
I should finally just clarify that I'm absolutely indebted to the work of a lot of scholars and academics who have done a lot, and I rely very heavily on them as well. This book is bringing things together to craft the story, but I don't want to take too much credit.
Absolutely. No. I mean, look, for all of you who are familiar with the work of Middle East, you may know Imran, as I mentioned in the start of this, one of our best and fantastic reporters. He's just turned 23, so he wrote this book starting at, you were,
well,
20 years old.
That's not true.
You...
I'm nearly 24.
So. But you started writing this book at what, 21, 22?
22, I guess.
22. Yeah. So you're just about to turn 24. Okay, yeah. That's news to me. Well, I mean, good, you know.
Well, you thought I looked that young to you.
No, I mean, I'm trying to say that clearly, as a young person, you've read a lot and you've written a lot and you're putting things together and clearly a fantastic storyteller as well. So thanks for your time, and I can only urge people who, if you've gotten this far in the podcast and you're still listening to us, you're definitely interested. So Imran, by the time this podcast is out, I think the book will almost be out, or out like a few days later. So The Indian Caliphate, the story of the exiled Ottomans and the billionaire prince, right?
Yes.
There we go. You guys should go. Any last words from you, Imran?
Thank you very much. I greatly enjoyed it. It's nice to be talking about something other than, contemporary politics.
So. Okay. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us, Imran.
Thank you.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not-so-unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfaq Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.